And as you're seated, if you would please find the book of Jonah, Jonah chapter 1. We are going to spend the next 4 weeks looking at this wonderful, widely known, widely loved Old Testament book. I will start us and finish us, and then in the middle 2 weeks I will be on vacation. In fact, this is my last official duty, except for a wedding here or there, for the next few weeks. I've already activated my, you know, my bat phone that only the family has the phone number to. It's a silver alert prevention device in case I wander off from them during vacation. They know how to find me, and so we're looking forward to spending some time together. But I am super excited about kicking off the series of messages that are focused on the book of Jonah. I want you to know right off the bat that I take the book of Jonah to be the real record of a real man who really lived and went through real things. Now, it's not something, that belief that all of this happened just as it is presented to us. It is not a belief that is required for salvation. Yes, it is possible to believe that Jonah is a morality play and still be a follower of Jesus Christ, but I think you start having some problems trying to explain it. For instance, Jesus thought it was real. Jesus used the event of Jonah being in the belly of a fish for 3 days as something that pointed to his own time in the grave and resurrection. So Jesus believed it real. If Jesus believed it's real, I tend to believe it's probably a good idea for me to believe it's real. But then also, if I just believe it is some kind of morality play, it lacks the impact in my life that it needs to have. You understand that? If it's just a morality play, I can decide, well, that's a cute little story, and it's like other fables that I read about. There's some things I can learn from it. But if it's real, it has an authority to it that causes me to say, okay, you know, I'm sometimes like a Jonah. And if God did that to a man who really lived, what might he do to this person who really lives when I try to run away from him? So I think it's best for us to really grasp onto the fact it's a real man, really happened, real events from his life. So let's begin. I ran from God once. Now, I have bolted from God like an ADD toddler in a mall, you know, momentarily, like all of us have from time to time. But I have only had one season of my life where I decided, you know what, God, not your way, but my way, and I'm going to take charge, and we're going to work by my plan, and I'm going to do what I want to, and I ran far, far, far away from home. That kind of thing has only happened to me once. It looks different in all of our lives. For me, it looked like something very particular and personal to me. I didn't want to be a pastor. I didn't want to be a pastor at all, so I tried to take the whole endeavor of my call and the trajectory of my life into my own hands, and God seemed not too pleased with all of that. We'll get to that a little bit later. I'll actually get the opportunity towards the end of our time today to share with you my story. But I share all of that with you because Jonah, as we know, was a man who ran far, far away from God. God told him very specifically he wanted him to do something. Jonah decided he didn't want to do it, and then we know what happened from there. So what I want to do this morning is I want us to think as we consider the event of the running, which is recorded for us in Jonah chapter 1, I want us to consider the methods God uses for a person of his that's sprinting away from him. And maybe by doing that, we will begin to see and have an understanding of things that are going on in our own lives that we've never really before thought about and wonder what might God have to do to get me to come back around. So let's look at Jonah chapter 1 and begin in verse 1, where it says, "Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, 'Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and call out against it, for their evil has come up before me.'" Now, to appreciate what Jonah is about to do, you have to appreciate what God has asked Jonah to do where. You see, Nineveh was a town that sat across the Tigris River, across from the modern-day city of Mosul, Iraq. And it was the capital in Jonah's day of the Assyrian Empire, the empire that harassed Israel more than any of the other nations that we have recorded for us in the Old Testament. And in the Old Testament, the Assyrians are portrayed as a brutal, brutal people. And that is actually undergirded by archaeological evidence. One of the Assyrian kings that is spoken of in Scripture is a man named Ashurbanabal. And Ashurbanabal had this lovely habit of tearing the lips, I said tearing the lips and the hands off of his prisoners. There's another king, an Assyrian king mentioned in Scripture, known as Tiglath-Pileser. Tiglath-Pileser had the lovely habit of skinning his opponents alive and then taking their skulls and stacking them outside of the cities that he had conquered. These were lovely, lovely people. And Jonah had been asked by God to go to these people and say, God's judging you. That didn't seem like something that had a lot of job security to it, as far as Jonah is concerned. And so Jonah asks to be released from his assignment. Really, he just kind of resigns it and bolts. And this is what happens. Look at verse 3. But Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish from the Lord, the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa, a seaport, to find a ship going to Tarshish. There's the second time that's mentioned. So he paid the fare and went on board to go with them to Tarshish. There's the third time that's missing, away from the presence of the Lord. So Jonah is going to where? There you go. You're bright, bright people. Now, where's Tarshish? That may be a little more difficult. Nineveh was roughly 550 miles to the east of where Jonah was living at the time. We take it to be that he was in the city of Samaria. Tarshish was 2,200 miles in the other direction. Tarshish is on the southern coast of Spain, right across from Gibraltar. So it's right at the edge of Spain. And because of the day in which Jonah lived, what that represented was the western edge of his map. You get that? So what he was doing here is saying, I'm going to go as far away from God as I can and still be on the planet. That's exactly what it is. As far away from God as I can go and still be an occupant of earth. That's what he tries to do. He's going as far away from God as he possibly can go. And what does God do? Verse 4. But the Lord hurled a great wind upon the sea, and there was a mighty tempest on the sea, so that the ship threatened to break up. Then the mariners were afraid, and each cried out to his God, and they hurled the cargo that was in the ship into the sea to lighten it for them. But Jonah had gone down into the inner part of the ship, had lain down, and was fast asleep. The weather started getting rough. The tiny ship was tossed. I'm not going any further with that. But it was being tossed about for a good reason. We're told that the Lord had hurled a storm on the sea. The word hurled in the language in which Jonah was written is a word that is used of a warrior throwing a spear at a fleeing enemy. And so you see what's going on here. Jonah thought he was going as far away from God as he could get. Surely he would be safe there. And God lines him up. And like a warrior throwing a spear, stops Jonah dead in his tracks. Not that any of this really mattered to Jonah, however, because he was asleep. That's not a metaphor for anything. The dude was legit asleep. God is trying to get his attention, and he is asleep. So how is that possible? There's actually been a lot of ink spilled as to why Jonah was asleep. Some have tried to make it a metaphor for the spiritual condition. That's been dismissed. Some people have tried to make it some kind of supernatural thing that had fallen over him. That was dismissed. The bottom line is the guy was asleep. Maybe he was asleep because of how exhausting it is running from God. You know, there's a lot of energy that is expended in trying to keep all the balls in the air when God has said, I want you going this way, and you choose to go this way. Perhaps he was just physically and emotionally and spiritually spent because of the energy he was expending in trying to run from God. God was in hot pursuit of Jonah, and Jonah was oblivious. He was only roused from his sleep by his terrified captain. Now, mariners at the time were notoriously pagan in their worship, and this crew would have been a follower of any number of gods. And so what they were doing as they began to realize nothing that we are doing is working to stop the storm, is they began to figure out, okay, whose God is ticked off? And so they came together, and they were trying to go through this system of figuring out whose God was the one that was angry, and they couldn't figure it out. And they said, is everybody present and accounted for? They said, no, there's this one dude who paid cash fare. He's down in the hold of the ship, and he's asleep. And so the captain goes and rouses Jonah. He rouses Jonah because he says, well, we can't figure out if it's one of our gods doing this. Maybe it's your God who is doing this. And so Jonah goes to the top, and he participates in the casting of lots. Now, the casting of lots was essentially throwing dice, and depending on how the lots or the dice fell, decisions were made as to what God was doing. And God intervenes in this process up on the ship by these pagan worshipers, intervenes in this process to say, the guy who's been asleep, it's that guy's fault. And so, in verse 8, they said to him, tell us on whose account this evil has come upon us. They know it's him. They don't even know the guy's name. It's one of these quiet things. I'm just going to pay cash. Don't ask any questions. Get me out of here. Whose account has this evil come upon us? What is your occupation? Where do you come from? What is your country? And of what people are you? And he said to them, I'm a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven. And then note this, who made the sea and the dry land. I've ticked off the God who's the God of everything. That would have resonated with them because, you see, pagan gods tend to be regional people, you know, mid-management out here. They're gods of the mountains. They're the gods of the trees. They're the gods of the plains. You can see that actually play itself out a few times in the Old Testament as the people of Israel encounter pagan cultures. And what Jonah has just told them is that my God's not a regional God. My God is the God. My God is the God over all things. And so then you get why. Verse 10 says, then the men were exceedingly afraid. That God, you've ticked off that kind of God? And they said to them, what is this you have done? For the men then knew that he was fleeing from the presence of the Lord because he had told them. So he's admitted to his travels companions that this is my problem. And then in verse 11, he says, or the scripture says, then they said to him, what shall we do to you that the sea may quiet down for us? For the sea grew more and more tempestuous. And he said to them, pick me up and hurl me into the sea, then the sea will quiet down for you, for I know it is because of me that this great tempest has come upon you. Nevertheless, it says in verse 13, the men rowed hard and tried to get back to dry land, but they could not, for the sea grew more and more tempestuous against them. Now, lest you think that these men are great humanitarians, don't overread it. Because you see, and we'll see this in the next verse, the reason that they are trying to get back to land is they think, well, you must be very important to this God, and I'm already kind of caught in the middle of this thing. If I kill you, this God's going to be mad at me. He's mad at you right now. I don't want him being mad at me. And so they don't want to do this. It's self-preservation. I'm not going to throw this man in. But then it doesn't work, and the sea grows more and more against them. And so in verse 14, it says, therefore they call out to the Lord, O Lord, let us not perish for this man's life, and lay not on us innocent blood, for you, O Lord, have done as it pleased you. This is the equivalent of Pilate washing his hands of Jesus' blood. They really don't care so much about Jonah. They just don't want to be responsible for what is about to happen. So they're covering their bases, and then we, of course, know what transpires from there. Verse 15, so they picked up Jonah, hurled him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made their vows. Don't overread that. That's not some sudden big revival on the boat. There's a big difference from recognizing God's power and committing yourself to that God. It's just that they were glad that they were not dead. They had a foxhole conversion that was not going to last very long in all likelihood. But then, of course, in verse 17, the Lord appointed a great fish to swallow up Jonah. And Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. God had finally gotten the running prophet's attention. Now, folks, when I filter my own story of running from God through the matrix of Jonah chapter 1, it becomes evident that the same methods that God used thousands of years ago to get a running man's attention are the same kinds of methods that he uses today when we decide for ourselves that we are going to run from God. It's not that God only uses these methods. He's an infinite God, and he is a God of creative variety. He can use any number of methods to call us back to him, but it's amazing to me when I think about my story of running how the things that God did in general for Jonah are the same kinds of things that he did to get my attention, and I think you'll find it amazing that he does the same kind of things when you go on your own journey of running. So let me share those methods with you, and then I'll share my story. It all starts with this: God speaks. It's a first method. It's not so much a method that he uses to pursue people when they're running as much as it is God just is in our world speaking. God came to Jonah and told him very clearly what he wanted him to do. You know, the most frequent word, most frequent verb that is used in the Old Testament is the word say. It's the most frequent verb in the New Testament. And it shows up most commonly in the phrase that begins the book. Now, the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, the word of God had come to Jonah. God had spoken to Jonah. Now, we're not told how this word came to Jonah. We don't know if it was audible or an overwhelming impression or if it came through his meditation on a particular passage of Scripture. We don't know if it came through the counsel of someone near to him. We don't know, but whether or not it came through his just growing awareness of his life circumstances that led him to a conclusion that God was speaking. My point is this: God is speaking. God still speaks in the world in which we live. God is not a silent God. He didn't suddenly become mute after the Bible was penned. God continues to speak in the world in which we live. The reason God speaks in the world in which we live is because he is anxious for us to know and to do his will. So the starting point with all of this is just the awareness that God speaks to me, like God spoke to Jonah, like God speaks to you. We serve a speaking God. And he is making his will known. And when we refuse to listen to that speaking God, he continues to speak, but in ways that are far less pleasant. Because from there, if we don't listen, God disrupts. And we can see this in Jonah. Jonah had a plan. Great plan. I will go the other way. God disrupted that plan with a storm. Sometimes our storms look like Jonah's. It's this existential crisis, a survival kind of thing. We're either going to live or die. We're either going to become this kind of person or we're going to become that kind of person. But sometimes the storm is a storm of frustration. The plan that you've swapped for God's plan blows up. Sometimes the storm is a storm of silence. God's presence, to which you become accustomed, becomes very distant. But make no mistake, when we run, God still disrupts. And then God humbles. God will humble the one who is running from him. A prophet in ancient Israel spoke for God to people in power, kings, and also to the people at large. And as such, they were essentially rock stars in the culture in which they lived. People who were respected, people who were loved, people who were admired. In fact, the most successful of them would have entire groups of prophets called schools of prophets that would kind of congregate around them, and they would kind of move as a posse, you know, all the way through ancient Israel. So if you were a prophet, you could easily feel pretty good about yourself. God spoke to you, you listened, you spoke for God. Not everybody got that gig. You must be very, very special. But to show Jonah just how little God needed him to speak for him, he uses a pagan ship captain to speak to Jonah in a very clear way that he would not have missed, but we may have overlooked. I want you to go back again to verse 2. When God speaks to Jonah, he says this, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and call out against it." I just want to leave it right there. And I want you to pay particular attention to the words, arise and call, arise and call. All right, now go to verse 6. The ship captain came to him and said, "What do you mean, O sleeper? Arise, call out to your God." Now, you may be reading an English version that switches those words up a little bit, and that's unfortunate. The English Standard Version from which I preach preserves the fact that in the language in which Jonah was written, arise and call are used when the pagan ship captain comes as well. What's God saying to Jonah? I can use a pagan captain who doesn't even know me to speak for me. I don't need you, but I've chosen you to speak for me to the people of Nineveh, and I am going to get my way. That would have been a humiliating experience. You think you're so special. You think you're a rock star. And then God uses somebody from the bleachers to throw a touchdown. God humbles. And then finally, God disciplines. Jonah was cast into the sea. But even in his discipline, the Lord is providing mercy in the fish. Jonah had to face his sin. And though it was unpleasant and terrifying, as we'll learn next week, the fish was God's way of providing Jonah an opportunity to make it right. Discipline, listen to me, discipline is the way God saves his people when they run. That's so important to grasp. Discipline is not punishing. Discipline is saving. Discipline is the way that God saves his people when they run. Now, folks, all of those things as principles happened to me when I ran. So let me share my story. When Julie and I got married, we had to take a personality inventory. Julie's came back, as you might expect, that she was responsible and mature. Mine came back that I'd peaked emotionally as a sixth grader. You know, I was a person who just was happy-go-lucky. I never took anything seriously. I didn't just live in the moment. I lived in the nanosecond. I was ADD run wild. And I took all of that immaturity and irresponsibility with me into youth ministry, which was okay because, you see, I was a youth minister in the era of church life where pastors were shallow enough to believe that great youth ministry, was when the kids had fun. And so I was fun. We had a lot of fun. I was not very effective at anything important, but I was a fun guy. And I looked in the midst of the little party that was my life at all of the grown-up things that my pastor had to deal with, and I said to myself, not me, not ever. But then, God began to speak. Through changing ministry responsibilities, affirming words when I preached, a host of things, God began to make it very clear to me that I needed to prepare to be a pastor, to which I said, not me, not ever. So I started to run. Now, runs look different for people. It depends on what you're running from. And here's one of the things that you need to understand. You can baptize your run. I mean, you can make it look like you are only trying to do the will of God, that you're very holy and that you're only concerned about what God might want from your life. And that's a lie that I could tell myself, and that's a lie that I could tell the people that I was serving. You see, what I did in order to run from being a pastor was that I resigned the church that I was serving in Tennessee as a youth pastor, and I moved to Colorado so that I could attend Denver Seminary, which at the time had the best student ministry program in the entire world. I never wanted to be a pastor, but surely God would be okay if I decided to grow up and be a better youth minister. And I would be the very best youth minister that I could ever be. And then God disrupted me. My whole plan hinged on Julie getting a teaching job. She'd just graduated from Middle Tennessee State University, selling her house, and me getting a part-time job. Julie could not get a teaching job for her life. Our house wouldn't sell. And I did get a part-time job, but that's all I could get. And Julie was not working at her full capacity. And so I could only afford to take two classes. And then I had to drop out of seminary. And I'd gone from, in the span of just a few short months, being the youth minister at a large church to being a stock boy at Walgreens. Now, Walgreens is great. I'm forever thankful for Walgreens because, quite frankly, they saved my family's bacon. I got to work there full time, and I qualified for insurance. But let me tell you, it was a humbling experience. Because I'd gone from having an expense account to working with some high school boys that, quite frankly, were friends of Beavis and his buddy. Honestly. That's the nature of the conversations I was having. And we didn't have enough income to live on our own. And so we lived in the spare bedroom of Julie's mom and dad's house in Littleton, Colorado, and then God disciplined me. He showed me that my call to ministry really wasn't mine at all, that it was His. I was the instrument He used, but the call was His. And He showed me what an immature, irresponsible human being I was to be this far along in life. And He broke my will. And I finally admitted that He was calling me to be a pastor. And I finally said I was willing to be one. And then the rest of the story, the good part of the story, was how God restored me. I went back to the church that I'd resigned in Tennessee, arrogantly. I'm here to do the will of God, and had to admit to hundreds of people on a Sunday morning that I had been lying to myself and them, and I was immature, and I was sorry. So I went back and did that. And they hadn't been able to find a youth minister in the time that I had been gone, and so they graciously extended an invitation for me to come back and be their youth minister, and I was voted on unanimously to come back. So my job that I'd run from, I was given back. As soon as I was voted in, a principal who attended our church came up to me and said, if Julie wants a job, she has one. So the job that Julie didn't get, she got. And her house had never sold, and we moved right back into the house where I'd concocted this plan. And I spent the next 2 years doing the most effective, most mature, most helpful student ministry that I had done in the 8 years previous, and then a month shy of my 30th birthday, on the recommendation of the pastor that I was serving who had watched me go through all of this, I began to pastor a church a couple hours away. When we run, it's because God has spoken, and we don't want to do it. And so, God disrupts. And then God humbles. And then God disciplines. And I am thankful He did. Because I would not be who I am today if it hadn't been for that. Frankly, I probably wouldn't be in the ministry today. And quite frankly, I'm terrified as to whether my family would have ever survived my immaturity. I'm thankful that God did all this. But none of it was fun. It was miserable. And it's kind of embarrassing to even talk about because it was so defiant. But maybe by me talking about a man 2,700 years gone and how my story tracks with his has helped you see how your story has tracked. And maybe you are now able to look back and piece some things together and know why it happened. But my bigger hope is this. My bigger hope is that there are some runners in here today. And you've been clueless as to why everything's blowing up. And you're going to say, that's why. God's hurled a storm at me. God has thrown the spear of His discipline to try to track me down. And I'm done running. And beyond that, my prayer for today is this. That you have been asleep in a boat and not known the world's coming down around your ears. And that this event from this man's life has started to wake you up. God speaks, disrupts, humbles, disciplines thousands of years ago and today.